It's The Takeaway for November 19th. I'm Tanzina Vega.
Mr. Vindman, you testified in your deposition that you did not know the whistleblower.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, please.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you testified.
It's a major day of impeachment hearings, and we'll walk you through the testimony. Also on the show, a proposed EPA rule change could overhaul what research the agency takes into account when creating public health regulations.
The limits that we use for clean air, clean water, it could undermine all of those.
And documents obtained by the New York Times shed new light on China's mass detention of Muslim minorities.
It becomes very clear when you see the documents that the authorities are quite aware of how this program affects families, takes parents away from children, and causes quite a lot of devastation to families that have people in the camps.
Lots to get to, so let's get rolling. WNYC's Arun Venugopal starts us off with an impeachment hearing update.
Hey, Tanzina. There is a lot to get to from today's public hearings, and I have Jamie Floyd, legal editor and host of All Things Considered at WNYC, here with me in the studio to go through what we learned so far. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Arun.
So this morning's hearings opened with a pretty forceful statement from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman about President Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. Here's what he had to say.
It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent.
Considering Vindman's role as a Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, Jamie, how significant was that opening statement from him?
I think that the Lieutenant Colonel, thus far, Arun, has been the most significant witness we've seen. His opening statement was incredibly powerful. He was direct. His facts were compelling. These witnesses we've seen today and that we will see this week are the witnesses with direct knowledge of the phone call, the infamous July 25th phone call. The witnesses we saw last week were setting the stage. But as the White House has pointed out over and over again, they did not have direct knowledge. They were laying the groundwork, if you will, for Adam Schiff, who chairs this committee and is a former prosecutor. So he knows how to set the scene, set up a case. But these witnesses, and Vindman in particular, was on the call. Many people were on the call, and that is not unusual, Arun, but he was on the call. He's a Ukraine expert. He's a Purple Heart hero. And the statement, Arun, he ends with turning to his father, who was a refugee from Russia, of all places, who brought his three sons and his wife to the United States. All three sons serve in the U.S. military. And he says, Dad, thank you for making the courageous decision to come here 40 years ago. Do not worry. I will be safe. I'm telling the truth. So his opening statement, incredibly powerful on the facts and incredibly powerful for who he is as a person, as a citizen, and as a witness.
We also heard from Jennifer Williams, who is a national security aide to Vice President Mike Pence. Here's what she had to say about the July 25th call in her opening statement.
During my closed-door deposition, members of the committee asked about my personal views and whether I had any concerns about the July 25th call. As I testified then, I found the July 25th phone call unusual because, in contrast to other presidential calls I had observed, it involved discussion of what appeared to be a domestic political matter.
So she says the call is unusual.
Yeah.
What else stood out to you about her opening statement?
Okay. Much was made of the fact that she's detailed to Vice President Pence. And essentially, so is Vindman. But that's how the White House works, Arun. I worked there. And, you know, listening today, more than last week, because I was never in Foreign Service, but I was in the White House a lot of years ago in the Clinton administration. But I was detailed from Vice President Gore's office to Hillary Clinton's health care war room. That is how it works. People are shifted all around according to their expertise. Mm-hmm. This woman is an expert in certain areas. She's essentially a public servant as well, a foreign service professional with a very hefty, she's not his administrative assistant.
Right.
She is advising him in certain areas related to Ukraine, essentially, and some other parts of that region. And so she being detailed to him doesn't take away from her extreme expertise in this area. And so we shouldn't make anything of that, though they did try to. She listened in on the call. She wasn't as aggressive in reporting it as Lieutenant Colonel Vindman did to the NSC, but she did note that she was concerned because she'd listened in on a dozen other calls, as is normal for someone in her position, and had never heard anything like this before. And her expertise counseled her to think something is not right here.
So let's talk about policy. How does policy come up in today's proceedings?
Well, it comes up almost immediately. I mean, when the Lieutenant Colonel testifies, he says, I was immediately concerned. He doesn't use the word outraged, but I immediately knew this was wrong because it was improper for the president to demand, is the word he used, that a foreign power investigate a political opponent. It was a partisan play. It undermined our Ukraine policy, which he was working on and was an expert in. It undermined our national security. And that is why he did report it, and he went to the NSC attorney, John Eisenberg. So those are the reasons, and the Ukraine policy was central to his concern. The stated Ukraine policy. Now, the Republicans will say, well, that's the Ukraine policy as you saw it. President Trump had a different policy in mind. But if we have a stated policy that our entire national security community is working on, the back channel policy really can't be something else. And that's what this impeachment inquiry is going to root out.
You used the word demand, which he himself used.
Yes, correct.
This was the subject of, I guess, of some discussion.
Yes.
Demand versus favor. And Republicans as well, I think, trying to sort of parse out the difference between one and the other. Take us there. How did he interpret what he saw as the president's use of the word favor as, in fact, a demand?
Well, he said, I am from a military background, as he sat there in his dress blues. And he said, I saw it as a demand because there is chain of command here. The president is a more powerful person with something critically important to offer. And when he asks, in quotes, for a favor, it's essentially a demand if you want that aid, if you want those missiles, if you want that meeting. So there's an understanding, says Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, and that understanding is essentially a demand.
At one point during the hearing, Republican Devin Nunes, ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, questioned Lieutenant Colonel Vindman about a member of the intelligence community who Vindman talked to about the July 25th phone call. And House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff cut in to warn Nunes against trying to out the whistleblower. Let's hear that exchange.
As you know, the intelligence community has 17 different agencies. What agency was this individual from?
If I could interject here, we don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower.
Please stop.
I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings. If the witness has a good faith belief that this may reveal the identity of the whistleblower, that is not the purpose that we are here for, and I want to advise the witness accordingly.
All right, so this is a really important exchange. It cuts to the heart of what's happening. The entire proceedings were launched because one person, the unnamed whistleblower, came forward, and now here we are. How did this play to you, Jamie
Floyd? Yeah, well, this happened several times today. The effort to tie Vindman to the whistleblower, the effort to bring the whistleblower's presence into this proceeding. In fact, before we even get to Vindman's testimony, Devin Nunes, in his opening statement, the ranking member of the Republican Party in the committee, spent a good part of his opening statement attacking the media, fascinating to me, but then attacking the whistleblower and the media for protecting the whistleblower, and then getting back into the Ukraine meddling theory, conspiracy theory, unproven, and the Biden storyline. So trying to shift everybody's focus back to President Trump's theory that Biden and his son should be investigated. So he spent a good portion of his opening statement on this whistleblower. And then when Vindman is testifying, is suggesting that Vindman, this conversation he's had may have been with this unknown whistleblower. And several times, to my count, Adam Schiff jumps in and asserts protection of the whistleblower. This is critically important for a number of reasons. Yes, the whistleblower launched this investigation, but also, Arun, protections for whistleblowers, federal whistleblowers, are not what they need to be. The need to protect this whistleblower is critically important, and there really is no need at this point to hear from the whistleblower because we have a long list of witnesses who can attest to the information that the whistleblower initially provided. And it's also, it's a bit of a red herring, I believe, this is my legal analysis, that the Republicans are putting out there to distract us from key witnesses who are on the call. The whistleblower told us about the call, but now we have the witnesses who are willing to come forward under subpoena, and were there. They were in the room where it happened.
Once again, we saw a Republican line of defense that sought to shift the focus of the hearings onto both the debunked theory surrounding a Ukrainian plot to disrupt the 2016 U.S. elections and also the role of Hunter Biden on the board of Burisma. Were they successful in advancing this agenda?
Well, you know, it depends on who you ask, right? I mean, my Twitter feed's blowing up with all perspectives. 30% are solidly with Trump, and there is nothing you are going to say to shift them off these theories, these fairly debunked conspiracy theories about Ukraine and Hunter Biden and Joe Biden. 30% are fully immersed in the Democratic pursuit of impeachment. And everybody else, I don't know. Are they catching fire with what's happening? Are they paying attention? What's happening? Are folks realizing that this is a moment of American history that they need to lock into? I certainly hope so, but I don't know. But I will say this. I don't think Hunter Biden should have been in Ukraine. If he'd been my son, I would have yanked him back over here, adult or no.
Yeah.
But that has very little to do with Joe Biden. Joe Biden was doing something completely different and following U.S. policy and European Union policy in recalling or actually ousting the prosecutor who was fired. And it's a very complicated story. And it's hard for busy working Americans or anyone to dial into that story. But it now is irrelevant. It's irrelevant, Arun, because the question now is, what did President Trump do? Even if Joe Biden had done something wrong, even if he had, which he hasn't, the sitting president cannot leverage pressure on a foreign government to investigate it. That is not legal. He's done something wrong if it can be proved he did that. And the witnesses are starting to come forward who were on the call and heard it. So whatever was going on in Ukraine, that call is problematic and very likely grounds for impeachment.
Jamie Floyd is legal editor and host of All Things Considered at WNYC. Thanks so much, Jamie.
Thank you, Arun.
At the heart of the House Democrats' impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump, there are questions surrounding a military aid package to Ukraine. The aid was eventually delivered in September, but various testimonies from government officials continue to reveal widespread concern that this aid was being improperly withheld by the White House for months prior. And while President Trump allegedly sought to leverage this aid to help his political fortunes for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, the stakes were much higher. Ukraine has been in an ongoing war with Russia since 2014, and despite Zelensky's goal to de-escalate that conflict, the toll of war can be measured in Ukrainian lives lost on the battlefield every week. Here with us for more on this Ukrainian perspective is Nina Jankowicz, a fellow at the Wilson Center. Nina, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us again, why is our Ukraine and Russia fighting and have been since 2014?
So you may remember after the Sochi Winter Olympics in 2014, as those Olympics were shutting down and the world's attention was elsewhere, Vladimir Putin slipped his troops into the Crimean Peninsula, which is part of Ukraine, and illegally annexed that territory. Ongoing throughout all of this was months-long protest in Ukraine after the then-president Viktor Yanukovych decided to pursue further integration with Russia and the Eurasian Economic Union instead of the European Union, which he had promised the people of Ukraine. And then in the summer of 2014, we saw an escalation in Ukraine's eastern region, the Donbass, where Russian military vehicles, Russian-sponsored fighters were crossing into Ukraine and taking thousands and thousands of lives. And as you said, today the death toll stands at least 13,000 Ukrainians that have lost their lives defending their sovereignty and territorial integrity.
So far in the impeachment inquiry hearings here in the United States, in the public hearings, we've heard some testimony about people who have gone to the front lines of this conflict. What is it like at the front lines right now?
So I've actually never been there myself because as an American, especially as one on a U.S. exchange program, as I was when I was on a Fulbright there, we were disallowed from going. But it's a dangerous place. There has been a de-escalation recently because the new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, ran on a promise of ending the war in Ukraine. But still, as you mentioned, people are dying every week. The area is still heavily mined. The people who are suffering most at the front lines are the very young and very old who have been unable to leave the area of the contact line because they don't really have another option. And so we're losing not only soldiers on both sides of the conflict, but ordinary people. And those are the people who are suffering the most as their services on both sides have been cut off. They're unable to receive their pensions. They're out of work and they're not receiving things like electricity and clean water.
We've been hearing a lot about the aid, and I wanted to take this segment, the opportunity in this segment to remind people what this aid is for. Can you tell us, Nina, how dependent on this aid is Ukraine in this conflict, and what does this aid generally get used towards?
Sure. So there's a lot of different types of aid that go to Ukraine, and certainly that has been on the uptick since 2014. There is this military aid, which is what we're focused on amid the impeachment inquiry, which amounts to about 5% of the Ukrainian military budget every year. There's also the purchase of Javelin anti-tank missiles by the Ukrainian government, which the Obama administration very famously refused to sell Ukraine, but the Trump administration relented and did sell Ukraine. Those actually, I would say, are more of a rhetorical form of support, showing Ukraine that the United States has their back and showing to Russia, basically, that you can't just unilaterally change the borders of a sovereign nation for the first time since World War II without consequences. And then we also give a lot of democratic support through organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy, National Democratic Institute, International Republican Institute, which are focused on rule of law and civil society issues, bringing Ukraine back toward the democratic fold, which it has been trying to kind of walk that path of democracy building for the past 30 years. But the thing that I think is important to underline is that all of these efforts, all of these foreign policy efforts, not only for the past 5 years, but the past 30 since Ukrainian independence, have been undermined by this withholding of aid. Even though it's been released, the rhetorical support that it has given the Ukrainian government as it faces Russian aggression, as Zelensky heads into negotiations with Putin on December 9th, all of that is undermined by the fact that it seems to have been withheld for political purposes.
We do know that, at least allegedly, what something that's come up in testimony is that President Trump has said he really didn't care, I'm paraphrasing here, about what happened in Ukraine. He was more concerned, again, allegedly, with investigating Joe Biden. National security officials say that U.S. national security is tied to Ukraine's success here. Talk a little bit more about what message that could send to Ukraine and other vulnerable nations who are backed by the U.S.
I think that point was made very eloquently by Bill Taylor during his testimony last week. He said, you know, this isn't just a conflict that's far, far away. This sends a message not only to Russia that this sort of interference can happen no matter what country they're operating in, but it sends a message to other aggressive nations who might have the idea that they can unilaterally change borders and use aggression to influence other nations. And that is very much against American ideals, not only in the foreign policy sense, but democratic ideals. We believe that, you know, nations have a right to self-determination, and that is at the very core of this issue here. And certainly, I think our credibility as the United States has been undermined on the international stage as well. And I think Marie Yovanovitch's testimony really spoke to that. How can our diplomats, who are supposed to be the emissaries of the president, know that their word is going to be taken, you know, seriously? seriously when we are sending our diplomats home essentially for political purposes. And I don't think there's any other narrative out there that has any credibility about why Ambassador Yovanovitch was sent home. So now we have this opportunity for shadowy figures who want to influence American policies to be running kind of shadow diplomacy, as we've seen. And we've seen how easy that is to unseat an American ambassador and to change American foreign policy toward a nation which we were supporting for the past 30 years.
Nina Jankowicz is a fellow at the Wilson Center. Thanks for joining us, Nina.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.
The EPA wants to adopt a new rule that would limit the scientific and medical research the government uses for public health regulations. Proponents of the rule say it would increase transparency by requiring scientists to disclose raw data, including confidential medical records. But the rule has also gotten a lot of pushback, including from scientists and the medical community. They argue that it would severely limit the contributions of science to lawmaking and allow legislators to cherry-pick which studies to include in their regulations. Here's Dr. Mary Rice, assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, expressing her concerns last week at a House hearing on the proposed rule change.
Our major objection to this proposal is that by excluding studies whose underlying data cannot be shared with the public, it would effectively block EPA from considering critical studies that involve real people living in the real world.
I sat down with Kendra Pierre-Lewis, a climate reporter for the New York Times, to find out exactly what this proposed rule would do.
So the new proposed rule is called Strengthening Transparency in Regulatory Science. And basically what they're saying is they require all scientists to disclose all of the raw data that goes into the scientific studies that help us make environmental rules. So, for example, there's a lead limit in water of, I believe, 15 micrograms per liter. That's a really tiny amount. Well, why is it 15 micrograms? It's because there's been a bunch of studies over the years, often in people, that figured out that, like, above that level, you start seeing health effects in people. But these studies are using people's private health information, so they don't disclose a lot of things. Would you want your private information disclosed in the interest of, like, the government making studies? No. And so absent that private information, the government is saying that those studies that are done using people's private information won't be allowed to be factored into making these environmental health decisions. But the problem is that there are, like, no studies that don't have that kind of private information in them.
I was just going to say, isn't that how science is conducted generally, like where we don't name the people, but we take information and have it at the aggregate and then present our findings?
Yes, that's generally how science is done. And there's another kind of pernicious level, which is there are some studies where communities have been accidentally poisoned. And as a condition of a legal settlement, they get health monitoring. And so in those cases, the only studies that we have are based on people within this community. So even if you, like, redact their name, if you, like, leave sort of the information that is important from a scientific perspective, like their age or their gender, it's pretty easy to figure out who you're talking about in that community.
What are some of the arguments or the motives, would you say, of the people who support this legislation? And we know this isn't a new rule. This has been around for a while. I want to talk a little bit about the history in a minute. But what's the argument in favor of this legislation?
They're saying that essentially full transparency, that because we don't have all of these extra details, we can't really know that we can't repeat it. We can't replicate it, right? We can't rerun the analysis that the scientists did. But the pushback against that argument is basically we're pretty much never making these studies on the strength of a single study. So it's not like one study says that lead in water is bad at you. There are hundreds of studies or thousands of studies at this point that say lead in water is bad for you. And so at that point, it's like, well, what are you really trying to get at? And as you mentioned, this isn't the first time the administration has sort of floated this rule. They've done it before. I think in 2018, they floated a version of this rule. But the big difference between this one and that one is that this one might retroactively apply to public health regulations already in place. And so the limits that we use for clean air, clean water, it can undermine all of those.
Kendra, would this give industry whether that's the oil and gas industry, for example, the opportunity to weigh in or the opportunity to push back on studies if there's a lack of what they consider transparent data?
Yeah, it would actually undermine sort of pretty much all of the limits that were have been set to date, really.
What's at stake here more broadly?
Clean air, clean water.
I don't want to be flip about saying that what's at stake in clean air, clean water, and kind of moving past that. I mean, that's a very serious thing to say. Remind us again how the EPA, what their involvement is with setting standards for clean air and clean water.
They look at all of the literature, and then they set sort of like a minimum standard, which is like how much, in this case, can be allowed in the water, how much can be allowed in the soil if a kid is playing on it, how much can it be allowed in soil generally. And the expectation is that above this level, you're going to start getting really serious health effects in people. So the idea is like minimum safe standard. Anything above this might be harmful to people.
Kendra Pierre-Lewis is a climate reporter for The New York Times. Kendra, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Strengthening Transparency and Regulatory Science Rule is awaiting approval from the Office of Management and Budget. And if approval is granted, a 30-day public comment period would take place. Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Over the weekend, an investigation from The New York Times provided new insight into China's mass detention of as many as a million Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other ethnic minorities in the western region of Xinjiang. An anonymous member of the Chinese political establishment leaked more than 400 pages of documents to The Times, including internal speeches from President Xi Jinping, that shed light on the origins and execution of China's growing network of internment camps. It's one of the most significant leaks in decades from the notoriously secretive Chinese government. And here to tell us about it is Austin Ramsey, Hong Kong correspondent for The New York Times and one of the journalists behind this new reporting. Austin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
You received hundreds of pages of documents that shed light on China's detention of minority groups in Xinjiang. What did we learn that was new here?
I think one of the most significant things about the documents is that it shows the gap between the way these camps are portrayed to the public, to the rest of the world by the Chinese government, and the way the authorities discuss the camps among themselves. And there's a pretty stark difference. The government describes these camps as sort of a mild education programs where people go to learn Chinese language and learn about the law and learn job skills that will help them improve their lives. But what they describe, the way they describe them in the documents are forms of punishment. And it becomes very clear when you see the documents that the authorities are quite aware of how this program affects families, takes parents away from children, leaves people without bodies to plant crops or to earn money, and causes quite a lot of devastation to families that have people in the camps.
Do we know how many people are being detained and what are the conditions of their detainment?
We don't know the exact number of people who are in the camps. There are no numbers in these documents, and it appears to be one of the more closely guarded secrets in these camps. There have been estimates of a million or more based on things like satellite photos and Tinder documents for the construction of camps and things like that. And there have been a range of scholars who have come up with these estimates. The conditions, there have been a few sort of visits for journalists, and they sort of see a model camp that seems almost like a sort of boarding school or something like that. But we have interviewed people that have described very difficult conditions where they might not have enough food or might have food withheld for punishment, or they might be beaten, particularly in the first periods that they're in the camps. And people describe them as very difficult places to spend long periods of time.
What do we know about the person or people who leaked these documents?
The documents were leaked by a member of the Chinese political establishment who wanted the leadership to be held accountable for the decisions made in terms of these programs. And that was one of the most interesting things to us. In addition to that person, the documents themselves also describe a couple of officials who were punished for not fully executing the detention program. There was one official who had 20,000 people put in camps and then let 7,000 of them out sort of on his own. And these officials aren't sort of human rights champions by any means. These are local Xinjiang officials who have been carrying out crackdowns throughout their career, but they seem to feel that this particular crackdown went too far, would exacerbate tensions in the long run, and would prevent them from reaching their economic targets that they needed to get promotions elsewhere.
Your reporting also found that President Xi looked to the United States post-9/11 policies when shaping some of these, his government's approaches to the Uyghur population. Help us understand that connection.
He described that sort of in terms of the way after 9/11 that the population in the U.S. sort of mobilized to monitor things that were happening around them. And he used the term from Chinese history of people's war, this idea of like organizing the population to carry something out. And he said, you know, we should be good at this sort of organizing the populace. And it's a way of sort of everybody watching each other, I think, was sort of how he was describing it. And that's what he was looking for, sort of a higher vigilance of neighbors watching neighbors to look for anything suspicious.
Austin, do we know whether or not the United States government has had a chance to look at this? I'm sure they are aware of the existence of these camps, but has there been any movement from the federal government here on how or whether to intervene?
I know there's been some discussion and criticism from the U.S. State Department and several congressmen, congresswomen, presidential candidates. There's also been discussion of using Magnitsky Act powers to punish officials, to target officials who are directly involved in these camps. But to my knowledge, I don't think there's been any action taken yet on that front.
Has the Chinese government responded to what you published in the New York Times?
They have. Initially, the first response came from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they did not challenge the authenticity of the documents, but they said that we sort of misinterpreted the camps and what they're meant to do and the conditions in them. Later, the Xinjiang regional government and also some Chinese ambassador in the UK did describe this as fake news and also said that we misinterpreted the camps.
Austin, do we know whether or not there have been any deaths so far in these camps? And if there have, are those numbers increasing?
We know anecdotally that there are deaths in the camps. We hear from people who have family members there, particularly members of the Uyghur and Kazakh exile communities abroad, who have reported about deaths of family members. But it's very hard to say if those numbers are going up or down or even what they are. I think it's important to point out that from everything we know, these don't appear to be death camps. That's not the purpose here. That it's not meant to you know, wipe out a population. But it does seem that there may be instances where people have not received maybe the medical treatment they need or the sort of harshness of these conditions on an older person could exacerbate conditions that they already have, things like that. So it is possible that there is a higher death rate, but we just don't know.
Austin Ramsey is the Hong Kong correspondent for the New York Times. Austin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we're going to switch gears and talk about the response from the international community, including the United States. With me now is Louis Charbonneau, United Nations Director at Human Rights Watch. Thanks for joining us, Louis.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard a pretty intense report from the New York Times based on hundreds of pages of leaked documents regarding these camps. What has been the international reaction to these conditions so far?
What we've seen in recent months has been a kind of escalation of outrage, I would say, and revulsion about the information that's been coming out. We've been doing a lot of research at Human Rights Watch on these detention centers, so-called re-education or vocational training camps. And I think that initially there was a lot of skepticism about whether the claims were true. I mean, to say that over a million Turkic Muslims have been detained in camps, which some people liken them to concentration camps, it's a bit hard to believe in the 21st century, but the fact is that there's more and more information that these are not some wild claims. This is actually happening, and it's happening on a massive scale. It's a kind of extremely creepy Orwellian program that the Chinese government has undertaken to alter the identity of an entire population in Xinjiang. So now people are realizing that this is true. And what is particularly disturbing of the documents that the New York Times came up with is that this is systematic. This is something that has been planned. It's being driven at the highest levels of the Chinese government. Xi Jinping himself is pushing this, demanding no mercy. These documents weren't a surprise, but they really show that this is a plan that has been worked out in great detail, and all of the denials that the Chinese government has been putting out into the public domain in recent months are simply hard to take seriously. What we have not seen, unfortunately, from the international community is a kind of overwhelming response to pressure the Chinese government to stop this. There are a lot of countries that consider what Beijing is doing in Xinjiang to be wrong, but most of them aren't saying it.
I feel like there's a lot of talking around this and not a lot of action. And I'm curious about whether or not the United States in particular, the Trump administration, has had any specific policy towards these camps or towards its relationship with China writ large. We know that the Trump administration has been at odds with China, if you will, when it comes to trade policy. Have they said anything specific about these detention camps?
Yes, the Trump administration has actually been pretty energetic on this issue. It's one of a small number of countries that have been the most outspoken. The U.S., Germany, and Turkey, they've been pressing the United Nations to speak out about this. They've been raising the issue regularly. Of course, there's a lot of skepticism about the U.S. position on China, as you quite rightly flag. I mean, let's face it, when it comes to human rights, the Trump administration is fighting an uphill battle when it comes to credibility. They're saying the right things about the Turkic Muslims, mainly Uyghurs in Xinjiang, but this is an administration that implemented the Muslim ban. Many people have difficulty reconciling the fact that an administration that was pushing the Muslim ban is talking about this, but they are doing it. It's something that we welcome. We would like to see the Trump administration being more principled on other human rights issues, but they are saying many of the right things here.
I'm curious about whether or not that talk is extending to countries that are predominantly Muslim as well, as this is the population that's really been targeted here in China. Are we hearing anything from Muslim-majority countries?
Unfortunately, we're not hearing very much from Muslim-majority countries. What we've seen is that they've been largely silent, or even worse, the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, has actually come out and praised China for its treatment of Muslims and specifically for what it's doing in Xinjiang. Now, individual countries, when you talk with Turkish officials, for example, they say that they were extremely disappointed by the failure of Muslim countries as a group to come together to condemn what's going on in Xinjiang. But you'll notice that actually Turkey, which has been so outspoken for a very long time on this issue, they've actually toned down their criticism of China. China has threatened retaliation against the countries, economic retaliation. They have made no bones about it, particularly with Turkey. They said publicly, if you want to go on criticizing us, then you're going to pay a price, a severe price economically. I think a lot of countries have heard this and they're afraid to speak out.
Is that something that you're seeing writ large in terms of the talk or the rhetoric around the Uyghur detention camps, but not a lot of firm policy? Is the fear of economic retribution really part of what's happening here?
I don't think that the United States necessarily is being driven on this issue, but for the vast majority of countries in the world, economics play a key role in this issue and their decision to keep silent. At the same time, China is not just an economic power, it's increasingly a diplomatic power. It's a permanent member of the UN Security Council with a veto. So a lot of countries don't want to cross China. We've seen a very good example of the kind of disappointing rhetoric from the international community is the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. He has been very reluctant to speak out about this issue. And we've seen the reaction of his spokesman yesterday when asked about the New York Times documents. They had a very unfortunate comment in which they said that they would like all countries to comply with human rights in the context of counterterrorism. And frankly, it would be better if they didn't say anything, because by talking about human rights in the context of counterterrorism, they're just reinforcing the Chinese narrative that this is all about fighting terrorists. It's very unfortunate that the United Nations is saying these kinds of things, but you know, the fact is the U.S. is pulling out of the United Nations, so China is increasingly playing an important role diplomatically at U.N. headquarters in New York. That's a fact. And so I guess that the Secretary General wants to do everything he can to avoid upsetting Beijing.
Despite the fact that these are could be considered pretty severe human rights violations. Louis, we're going to have to leave it there, but I appreciate your time. Louis Charbonneau is the United Nations Director at Human Rights Watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And that's our show for today. And we've got a big week of impeachment hearings coming up. So if you're following along, give us a call and tell us about the moments of testimony that really stand out to you. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Or tweet me directly. I'm at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.